This episode of the Tripwire podcast is sponsored by BetterPitch, the experts in pitch deck design for the real estate and private equity sectors. BetterPitch is here to help you unlock your business potential. They specialize in creating beautifully designed, professional pitch decks that make a lasting impact on investors. Are you tired of dividing your time between graphic design and securing funding for your next deal? BetterPitch is the solution you've been waiting for. They take the hassle out of creating your pitch deck so you can focus on what truly matters, building your business. And here's the best part. BetterPitch extends a risk-free offer exclusively for listeners of the Tripwire podcast. They will work with you until you're 100% satisfied, accommodating as many revisions as you need. Ready to take your pitches to the next level? Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity. Book a call with BetterPitch today and get ready to impress investors with the perfect pitch deck. Visit BetterPitch.com, that's BetterPitch.com, to schedule your call and unlock the power of beautifully designed professional pitch decks from BetterPitch. This is Tripwire Week in Review for the week ending June 2nd, 2023. I'm Haley Keene with Trip, a data modeling and analytics firm for the CMBS, commercial real estate, and CLO markets. I'm with Manus Clancy, Senior Managing Director, and Lonnie Hendry, Head of CRE and Advisory Services. This week, investors breathed a sigh of relief after President Biden and House Speaker McCarthy reached an agreement on a debt ceiling deal. The relief got even bigger as the deal started working its way through Congress. On the data front, there were some modestly positive signs for the U.S. economy. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index for May fell compared to April, but came in well above analyst expectations. In addition, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index also came in above estimates. On the negative side, the Chicago Business Barometer hit a six-month low while missing expectations by a wide margin. Now that the debt ceiling drama is behind us, it's back to our regularly scheduled programming with upcoming jobs reports, inflation numbers, and another Fed decision. Manus, where do you see things going right now?
Well, I think we're all grateful that the debt ceiling issue was handled maturely. We didn't go quite up to the 11th hour. We went up to about the 10th hour. It seemed like both sides gave up something. Anytime I hear both Republicans and Democrats griping, I get the sense that a deal was kind of fair. Each side gave up something. I think the best parts of it are we are doing things to curtail our spending. Certainly our spending over the last 2 years has been, I wouldn't say excessive. We had a crisis, and sometimes crises require excessive steps. And that's what we did during COVID. But I do think it was time to reverse the flow, so to speak. And I think this deal does that. It probably doesn't do it to the extent that conservatives would love, but I think taking away that inflationary pressure that was building from government spending was really important. So I think spending caps, returning unspent COVID money, and other steps in that bill, I think are a good thing. Getting past it without it triggering a huge sell-off in the stock market is also a good thing. Now, to your point, Haley, we return to the normal scheduled programming. And what does that mean? I think it's a good question. I think the fact that we had a debt ceiling deal done now probably puts more pressure on the Fed to raise rates. I think there was a thought process that they would hold off in the event that a debt ceiling crisis triggered a liquidity issue. That is now no longer on the table. The JOLTS numbers came in today significantly higher than expected. As you pointed out in the open, the Case-Shiller National Home Price Index came in above estimates, as did consumer confidence. So I think that what we see now is a situation where we're back to, let's call it mid-April, where there's some positive economic data. Odds are rising that the Fed will increase rates. And now we are turning our attention to CPI, jobs, and other economic indicators.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head, Manus. It's rare these days that we talk about stuff coming out of Washington in a perspective of, you know, someone getting something done until they absolutely have to. And I think we were set up for kind of a showdown when we didn't have a deal a couple of weekends ago. but ironically, it seems like they came together. Cooler heads prevailed. Both sides gave up something, and we get a deal done, which locks in, like you said, some spending, you know, caps in place for the next couple of years. We have an election coming up in 2024. I think from all perspectives, this is a good day, a good week for the U.S. economy, and it avoids a lot of the nonsense that I thought we were probably going to face. If I had had to answer the question last week, if we would have a deal in place, I was honestly, you know, thinking that we were probably going to be in the last minute. You may have some furloughs or shutdowns or things happening until they actually reached a deal. So I'm excited the fact that they got something done. And I do think that you're right in the sense that it now turns the everyone's attention to what the Fed's going to do. And I think it puts the Fed in a precarious spot because some of the inflation numbers and some of the employment data that they look at still supports probably another rate increase. And so I think that we're probably going to see that now, which we wouldn't have seen if they hadn't gotten a debt deal done. So I think, you know, all in all, it's great that the broader macro has calmed down on the debt ceiling, but I think we're going to have plenty to talk about over the next couple of weeks as the Fed contemplates another increased rate hike. You mentioned a couple of other, you know, metrics, consumer confidence. It looks like in May it fell. You know, it says Americans, particularly older ones, became more pessimistic about the labor market on top of elevated anxiety over inflation. And in the S&P, you know, Case-Shiller Index, looks like home prices were, you know, 0.7% higher than in March of 2022. So it's really interesting. You would think with the interest rate environment on single family residential, 30-year fixed rates have eclipsed 7% on the interest side, that you would see a, you know, pretty significant decline in pricing. But we've never had a situation where 80%+ of the market's locked in at, you know, 3%+ interest rates. Those folks are not selling. And so even though the market demand would have waned due to higher interest costs now, the low supply is winning that competition. And so prices are continuing to increase. So it'll be interesting to see what shape this takes over the next 6 or 8 months if home prices continue to rise, or if people finally hit a breaking point where they say, we're just going to continue to rent. We have had some cooling down in the rental market, which is nice. And I think timely given where we're at with home construction. You know, all in all, I think a really good start to this upcoming June. And I'm optimistic that the economic news to follow will be as optimistic as well.
So let's pivot for a second before we get into some property type and data specifics. I wanted to move from kind of the macro, which is the debt ceiling and some of the big data that we saw, including the housing data that Lonnie was talking about, and talk specifically about a few things we saw in the commercial real estate market over the last month. We are entering a new month of June. We had a lot of headlines during the course of May, office defaults, office delinquencies, and other things that caught our attention. And I want to go through a couple of things, maybe a month in review, that to talk about the state of the market. First of all, I'll go through a couple of positives in the market. The first was the PacWest portfolio sale. PacWest, you may recall, was one of the banks that was under siege over the last few weeks. Stock price really volatile, had fallen to microscopic levels. There was talk about a takeover. A couple of weeks ago, or maybe less than a week ago, we saw that big $2.6 billion portfolio sale by PacWest, which I thought was a green shoot, Lonnie. We saw that portfolio of construction loans trade for, it was either 92 or 94 cents on the dollar, which in a period of, I would say, falling liquidity and an absence of comps, getting that kind of execution on a portfolio, I thought was a nice marker for this market. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that was a home run deal. I mean, all things considered, and that was the construction portfolio, if I remember correctly, which generally is a more risky endeavor for the lender. And so I think for them to be able to walk away with 92, 94 cents on the dollar for that deal bodes well for just their ability to exit. And I think, you know, kind of give some perspective on how the market perceives that portfolio going forward. And so you know, if you had asked me before that transaction, there's no way I would have said that it would only taken a, you know, 6 or 8% haircut. It would have been something dramatically more, in my opinion. So I think all in all, good sign for the marketplace there.
And it comes on the precipice of what will be other asset sales coming up. We read this week that Newmark was on the verge of putting out the first tranche of assets that they inherited from failed banks, loans that were not taken over by acquiring banks that they're selling on behalf of the FDIC. So I think that this PacWest sale starts off what may be a wave of selling over the next 3 months on a really positive, positive note. So, and another positive note, we've mentioned this before, that the CMBS market does not do particularly well during periods of heightened volatility. I think I had a fear that with the debt ceiling deadline looming, we may see a drying up of lending, a drying up of issuance. Nothing could be further from the truth. We saw a nice month where several single asset and several conduit deals priced this month. The market was open for business, certainly not at the levels we saw in early 2022 or 2021, but seeing multiple conduit issues come to market is a very positive sign. I wanted to talk about the last one to price to give our listeners a sense of what we're talking about. BMO brought a deal that priced in the last week or so, a $660 million CMBS deal, small by historical standards, but not terrible. We've seen a lot of deals getting done in the $600 to $800 million range. The AAA tranche, the 10-year AAA tranche, traded with or cleared with a spread of 167 over the curve. The AA minus, 250 over the curve, which I think was a terrific testament to the strength of this deal and the execution. The last two AAs to price were at 300 and 310. So this was 60 basis points inside the last AA trades that got done. And the single A minus at 390, similar story there, 55, 65 basis points tighter than the previous conduits had priced 2 weeks earlier. So not only was issuance getting done, it was getting done at fairly tight levels relative to where we were a month ago. Running through a couple of stats on this, just for those that might be curious, weighted average coupon on this particular portfolio, 6.65%. Weighted average debt service coverage ratio, 173. Weighted average LTV, 54. Weighted average debt yield, 12.9. And the breakdown of the pool, retail, 28%. Industrial, 25%. Industrial remains a darling of the industry right now. We'll talk more about that later. Lodging, 15%, and office, almost 12%. So for those that think there is no lending going on for office, not really true. It may be constrained and it may be a very tight market, but there are some deals getting done.
Yeah, it's really great to see that, because I know if you look at the first quarter of this year and even into April, there was pretty much no issuance across the spectrum. And it kind of reminds me, Manus, when we were first starting this podcast out coming off of COVID and the markets just dried up and like nobody knew exactly how to issue a deal or what the market wanted. And, you know, I guess from the optimistic perspective, we would say maybe they've found something that works here. Maybe it's that $600-800 million, you know, type deal. Maybe it has an allocation across property types like you've outlined here, and the market's receptive of that. And hopefully for all of us involved, it will allow those transactions to start happening again and some of that information to start flowing through the markets and liquidity being there. So I take this as a positive sign. It's good to see that we had a couple of other deals come online as well. And it maybe signifies that people are realizing we're getting close to the peak for interest rates with the Fed, and that maybe some certainty is coming back to the marketplace. And as we've talked about, commercial real estate can operate in high interest rate environments. What it can't operate in is in uncertain environments where people don't know how to price or underwrite. And in this case, if we're 25 or 50 basis points away from where we're going to be, I think the markets are starting to come to terms with that, and it's good to see.
And I think to your point, Lonnie, we can find some tie-ins there to some of the comments we saw this week from billionaire Ross Perot Jr., whose family is one of the largest property developers in the country. And he was warning of a looming real estate recession if banks don't start lending again.
Well, I think it's a continuation of the point that Lonnie just made, right? That commercial real estate does not operate when the pipes are frozen. And we're fortunate that the CMBS market is not frozen. We're fortunate that there is some bank lending going on, but I do think that we are entering a period, maybe you could say we're not out of the woods from the banking crisis 2 months ago, or maybe it's a continuation of what is a challenging market overall. But when you look at the four or five pillars that make up commercial real estate lending, banks constrained right now as they continue to remain concerned about deposits. CMBS operating, but at a much lower velocity than last year. B-piece and mezz loan lending through the CRE CLO market, virtually non-existent at this point. So that's shut off. And so what you're left with is really the insurance company market. So I think that we should take stock of where we are right now, where if you're looking at the glass half full, any lending is good lending. But I think you can't dismiss Mr. Perot's point, which is that if the markets don't operate and open soon, you will see projects go to the wayside, construction deals not get done, and the U.S. economy, as it pertains to commercial real estate, start to falter.
Yeah, I think for Perot, I mean, they have a unique perspective of being a developer, and they're a really large developer. They're actually based in Dallas, Hillwood, and they've done some really, really amazing projects. And to your point, Manus, on the construction side, I mean, it seems like as capital's dried up, you know, the first set of loans that get shut down, I guess, are these speculative development deals, because there's just a lot longer time horizon on return for those deals, and there's more risk involved. And so from his perspective, I could see how maybe it's a little more daunting than some of these other stabilized property operating cash flows. Even though it's tighter to get those deals, you're still getting them done. But I'm with you. I mean, there's maybe a few inklings of some positivity around the marketplace. And I think if the Fed comes out this month and says, we're not going to raise rates, then you could really see things reignite. And if they come out and say, this is our last 25 basis points, again, I think you're going to start seeing things pick back up. So interesting perspective from somebody in the know. He definitely has done a lot of deals and has a lot of experience in the marketplace. And he joins another group of large office owners and others that have been saying for months that, you know, the government and the interaction between the Fed and the market has really stymied what we're able to do on the CRE space.
For our younger listeners out there, or even some that are not that young, I guess if you're, you know, as old as maybe 45, you may not know this, but his father was a presidential candidate. And I was just thinking about this as Haley was bringing up this remark that he must be turning over in his grave today, because his big thing for running for president was the deficit. And back then, the deficit was a quaint couple of $100 million per year. The entire U.S. deficit was probably under $100 trillion now. I think that, you know, if he heard that we were sitting on $31 trillion worth of debt, he would definitely be turning over in his grave today. He was a real deficit hawk.
So let's shift our focus here. I know we talked about a few positive and optimistic signs in the economic markets and some of the data there. But in CMBS, we are seeing other concerns, and we saw that today with our latest delinquency report.
Yes, this was kind of a whopper. People had been expecting distress in CMBS for quite a while. I think ever since we started seeing eights and nines on CPI last summer and interest rates start to surge, I think that the expectation was that floating rate debt would start to default in droves, and that refinancing costs would force a whole nother set of borrowers for fixed rate debt into default as well. The uptick in delinquencies had been quite unimpressive or light for the last year. We were talking about a couple basis points here and there month after month. We weren't that much higher than our low. I think we were only about 15 basis points below our post-COVID low as of last month. But that all changed today when we ran our numbers for the end of May. The overall delinquency rate for CMBS up more than 50 basis points, now up to about 3.6%. It represents a 14-month high. The month-over-month increase of 53 basis points was the highest jump since June of 2020, which was when the market just exploded with delinquencies. We were in the third month of COVID at that point. And most alarming of all is the office segment, which was already up 100 basis points year to date as of April. The rate on office has jumped another 125 basis points in May, now over 4%. You have to go back to 2018 to see the last time office delinquencies were above 4%.
Yeah, so I think we're at a point now where we thought we probably would have been a couple of months ago in terms of crossing that 4% threshold for office. I mean, it had been hovering at 1.8, 2.2, 2.6, and we knew that there was more to it. And even at 4%, I still think this is just scratching the surface. I wouldn't be shocked if we end the year in double digits in the office market. I think if you follow the headlines and look at the number of large office owners that are saying they're going to toss the keys back, that number is going to grow over the next couple of months. But to see it significantly shoot up, you know, over 4% this month, I think was a little bit surprising that it hadn't happened sooner. I wouldn't be shocked to see another 50 or 100 basis points next month. I think we're starting to see some of these things play out. I read a couple of articles and saw some stuff on Twitter today where we're starting to get a little bit of price discovery on some of these larger office loans. We're going to talk about that here in a little while. And I think as those dominoes start to fall, you're going to see a lot of these other office owners that are kind of teetering on the brink start tossing the keys back and quit making payments, and that delinquency numbers continue to increase. Yeah, overall delinquency, though, still, even though it's 53 basis points, 3.62, not too alarming for me when you factor in office and you factor in the legacy retail stuff. Industrial still good, multifamily still good, lodging relatively, you know, still good. So all in all, not totally surprised, maybe mostly surprised at the fact that we're in, you know, effectively June and just now crossing that threshold on the office sector.
I could picture Lonnie going viral in the next couple hours with that office delinquencies could go above 10%. That, you know, we could see Lonnie ping-ponging all over social media for the next couple days after that remark. Let's perish the thought there. I wanted to give two more contexts on the office, the 4.02%, which was, as we said, the highest number since 2018. Context number one, in 2018, when we were last at 4% for office, a lot of those loans that were delinquent at the time were loans that were made during the mania of 2007. So what you had then was really bad underwriting, you know, loans that just had terrible standards, overvaluation, overly favorable terms, de minimis amounts of skin in the game. So for us to now be at 4% versus a period of time when the underwriting was terrible, I think is a little bit alarming. And if we're on our way to 5, 6, 7%, or even 10, as Lonnie suggested, versus a similar number when underwriting was in the dumps, I think that's really worrisome. The other thing I would say is I just wanted to add this for context. When we do our delinquency numbers for loans that miss their maturity date, but are current on interest payments. So this would include loans that may have an extension option. The extension option is in the works, hasn't been finalized, and for 1 month, the borrower has missed the payment that was due before an extension was triggered. If we included those as though they were delinquent, the delinquency rate overall would have been closer to 5%. So you look for our report. It is out for clients now. It'll be out for the broader market as well shortly thereafter. I think a lot of concern there.
Yeah, just quickly on that, Manus, one point. I agree that the underwriting standards leading up to 07 were kind of one-off. You know, like they had all these pro forma underwritten financials and they were underwriting to stabilize. But do you think that there maybe is an inflation in some of the current underwriting in the sense that, you know, for the last 4 or 5 years, we've heard people say things like, lowest loan to value percentage across the spectrum by any of the asset classes over the last 20 years and all this stuff. But isn't that propped up by the low interest rates and everything that we've seen? And like some of these office properties, especially the large office properties, if you look at them, a lot of them have been in CMBS for 2 or 3 deals consecutively, and they've just cashed out equity on each refi. They're full-term IO, and they haven't put any of that CapEx into the property. So I wonder if like we're going to start seeing, you know, at least for the office sector specifically, maybe what we thought was really strong underwriting start to unravel a little bit as these things start to come online at 70% occupancy and the value mark to market is significant. It just makes me wonder if we got lulled a little bit into, you know, really low LTVs when in reality those were propped up because interest rates were effectively zero.
That's a great question. And I think the tell will be, and you're kind of giving me some work for next week already. This is not very welcome, Lonnie, I got to say. I think the tell is of the loans that are delinquent, what are they made in 2013 and 14 when rates were higher and the underwriting was different? Or are most of the delinquencies now coming from things that were made floating rate in 2020 where the borrower is giving back the keys rather than extend? And that's something we'll try to have an answer on next week. I think that that's a really interesting question. Maybe, you know, trifurcate the breakdown into, you know, maybe 2013 to 16, 17 to 20 and 20 and beyond and see what the breakdown is by those vintages for delinquency. I think you're onto something. My gut tells me that the data is going to say that a disproportionate amount of the defaults we're seeing are things that were done in 2020 or after. So we'll see. We'll have that answer next week. Stay tuned.
So let's continue on the topic of office. This week, the CEO of Wells Fargo came out and said that there will be losses in the office loan space, but the lender will be proactively managing its portfolio.
Ah, saying the quiet part out loud. I joke about that, actually. All the CEOs of all the major banks are trying to get ahead of this office thing. For the last 2 months, it's been a common thread when you see CEOs after earnings come on CNBC. They all are very focused on this office, trying to convince investors that they have their portfolio under control. I think the quiet part said out loud was the assuring of listeners that Wells Fargo would have losses. I think every bank will have office losses. It's only a question of how big they are and how good their underwriting has been over the last 5 years. So I think this is a story we'll still be talking about 24 or 36 months from now. The banks are in for a long haul. We started seeing it with M&T probably 2 months ago when they said they thought that there were significant losses sitting in their office portfolio book. Since then, others have come out and Wells Fargo today. So I think it's of a piece.
Yeah, just for some context there, I think at the end of March, Wells Fargo had an outstanding commercial real estate loan book at about $155 billion, which is about 16% of their total loans. And about $36 billion of that was concentrated in the office sector. So the acknowledgement of what everyone knows is great, but it'll be interesting to see what those losses actually look like when some of these deals start to trade. And I think that's what we'll be keeping our eyes on for sure.
And sticking with office, we saw a lot of major stories this week. Let's run through them.
So I'm going to break these down first so I don't. Last week, we had a listener say that my prior podcast, which was 2 weeks ago, and by the way, Lonnie and Haley and Steven, who's not with us today, but is, I'm sure, listening. Nice job last week in California with a live podcast. But 2 weeks ago, I ran through a lot of office stories, and one Twitter respondent said, I sounded like the weatherman on AM radio going through the school closings on a snow day. I don't know if that's nostalgic or an insult. I'm not quite sure. But as one who looks back very fondly on snow days from my youth, I'll take it as a nice thing to say. So I'll start with a couple of sublease stories, and then we'll get into crabgrass and green shoots. For me, the biggest crabgrass or biggest sublease story of the week came from the San Francisco Business Times. They reported that Google LLC has put 1.4 million square feet of space on the market in Northern California. This covers several markets. The Marfa Towers area is one big one that is heavily weighed toward Google space. In total, Google there has about 740,000 square feet, and I think something like 600,000 square feet of it is being made available for sublease. Seven properties in all with an average size of 200,000 square feet each. And that's coming on top of so many other stories in the Bay Area of people putting and firms putting space on sublease This is just not a positive development, not a real surprise. We knew that Google had set aside $500 million to cover lease termination costs and other commercial real estate expenses. And this seems to be the start of it. In Georgia, AT&T has put 200,000 square feet out for sublease at Midtown 1 and 2. This is a property we're watching very carefully. The property backs $124 million of CMBS debt. The AT&T space is solely occupied by AT&T. Recently, AT&T told their workers they were coming back to the office. They also told workers they were going to consolidate space around 9 hubs. Atlanta is one of those hubs, which may be a good thing for Midtown 1 and 2, or it could be a terrible thing. If the firm decides to extend at Midtown 1 or 2, great. But the fact that they're subleasing space there already could be a tell that they are looking for other space in that Atlanta market. So that one we're watching closely. Another one we're looking at in the Sacramento Business Journal, Ben Vandermeer reported that Centene is looking to sublease all or some of its North Natomas campus, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. This is at 4151 and 4191 Commerce Drive, another huge swath of space, 500,000 square feet at that campus that is coming to market. In Phoenix, Ron Davis, Phoenix Business Journal, Carvana, who's been an active subleaser, putting 300,000 square feet out at Marina Heights. This is space that they had taken over from State Farm a couple of years ago. And then Lonnie, I'm very curious to get your thought on this one. It comes from your neck of the woods. CityLine State Farm, I'm sure you're familiar with that. I think it's a 2.8 million square foot campus, sale lease back to State Farm. State Farm was the sole tenant. The leases go until 2036 to 2041, a lot of time left on those leases. State Farm has been subleasing everywhere, and they've already put 400,000 square feet of space out for sublease at CityLine. That's the background. The loan on CityLine matures this month. The owners of the property have to sell the property to refinance the loan. Given the fact that the leases are so long, that's a positive. Given that State Farm clearly has been reducing space at an extraordinary pace, does this sale get done or not get done? What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. This was a really big deal when this came online. This was a build-to-suit sale-leaseback type of scenario at construction. Really big news. It's in Richardson. I think what we're seeing here, though, is just the risks that get concentrated when you have such a large, you know, 2 million plus square foot building or campus effectively, you know, occupied and leased by one major tenant. Even with the lease in place, it creates some challenges for the market. If the conditions deteriorate like they have, and you have somebody looking to refi that has to try to take the property to sale, it degrades the value of the asset. I mean, I think the property was appraised close to $900 million back in 2016. It'll be interesting to see if this deal gets done. I think in any of the markets that we cover, this North, you know, Dallas suburb market is still really, really a strong market relative to the other markets in the U.S. State Farm, still a great tenant, long-term leases in place. But to your point, there's definitely some headwinds. You know, what's interesting on this one, kind of as a funny aside, you know, I think about some of the really, really small tenants in some of these spaces that we might take for granted. But imagine being like the coffee shop or the sandwich shop that like rents a 2,500 square foot space at these buildings. And you think, oh, this is great. We finally got in there. We got these tenants in here for 20 years and we're going to have business forever. And then no one comes back to the office and then they start subleasing space. There's really some negative consequences for them. And I know in this instance, I think there were one or two small food vendors that had space there. I wonder how they're doing. So to answer your question, I think something gets done on this deal because the underlying fundamentals are still strong. But I definitely think it doesn't get done at a price point or at a marker where people will feel like they achieved their objective when they went into this deal on the front end.
Yeah, I think if you go back and look at some of the biggest losses we've ever had in CMBS, these built-to-suit campuses, like for an AT&T or other telecoms or for big pharma, I bet you those are some of the biggest losses we've ever seen, because repurposing these things is not easy, and the sheer amount of space is extraordinary. Moving on, I'll move on to crabgrass very quickly. One crabgrass story here. Commercial Observer's Brian Paskus reported that RXR / Scott Reckler announced they were walking away from 61 Broadway. They are defaulting and handing back the keys on a $241 million loan. That's a 33-story office tower in Lower Manhattan. Reckler had been on the record as saying he was the owner of, I think it was, touch-tone phones in a cell phone world. He said he would be giving back properties. Here's the first one, and it's a biggie, $240 million. Two green shoots very quickly. In Marlboro, Mass., a new property there was sold for $91 million. This is a 140,000-square-foot state-of-the-art property that was acquired by Moderna. The developer was Oxford Properties. And in Denver, this comes from Thomas Gownley of Business Denver. The Republic Plaza has been a topic of a couple of trading alerts. The loan went delinquent. Value was cut. Occupancy fell to 67%. Backs a big CMBS loan, about $200 million in total. Collateral value was cut from $500 million to $300 million last year. Mr. Gownley reports that the Denver district attorney has taken a lease there for 75,000 square feet. So that should bump up occupancy at that property and may staunch some of the negative headlines for that. Let's hope so.
Yeah, let's circle back to the RXR real quick, man. So I saw some stuff online today that said the JLL is going to be marketing that loan for sale, and the market participants are estimating that the property or the loan will transact at, you know, less than half of the $440 million valuation from back in 2016. So this is one that maybe is even underwater on just the loan side. So more to come on that as the market starts to you know, figure out what is the haircut going to look like on some of these buildings. There were a couple of other stories this week that we didn't even get into. Silverstein Properties had a property that traded, and then Blackstone, another property, One Liberty Plaza, that they had sold an interest in for a pretty large haircut relative to what their initial stake was. So we're starting to see some of the office transactions take place. And what we don't know is this going to be kind of a precursor to more of a systemic set of transactions, or are these still going to be viewed as one-off with some people holding out as long as they can?
So let's turn to retail, Manus. I know we were watching a few retail sales this week.
In retail, we saw a couple of nice stories this week, one nicer than the other. The first one comes from Louis Lovio, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, I hope I am, of the Business Observer. The Westfield Brandon Mall has been sold. People may recall that Unibail, Redamco, Westfield has been trying to sell their malls. They've been trying to do so for about 24 months. It's been a slog. They've sold a few, but not a lot. This particular property is 1.15 million square feet, and it's sold for $220 million. The buyer was North American Development Co., along with an unnamed institutional investor. So I like to say that anytime you see a mall sell for nine figures plus, it's a good sale. So it just shows that not all malls are obsolete and not all malls are going to become jungle gyms. So a good story there. The other one, not quite as good, but still okay. The Shops at Wiregrass, which is an open-air shopping center in Wesley Chapel. And by the way, this comes from Ashley Gerbel-Kreitzer of the Tampa Bay Business Journal. The Shops at Wiregrass sold for $70 million. The positive story is that's still a healthy price tag for a property, you know, the high eight figures. The downside of this is this thing took about $150 million to develop in 2008. So real degradation in value. The collateral is about 500,000 square feet. DSCR for the property was only 1.05x in 2021. So if you're looking at the glass half full, you're saying, well, for a property with that kind of skinny DSCR to still get 70 million, that's a good sign.
Yeah, I think both of these just show that there's utility at certain price points. And so, you know, that's the takeaway here is that these properties are still viable in the market with a reset basis. And in the case of the shops at Wiregrass, I mean, that's to the tune of about a 60% reduction from the construction cost. But hopefully for the new buyer, they can buy it at a low price, relatively speaking, increase debt service coverage, offer some incentives, and hopefully this turns into a good investment for them and for that local Tampa market.
So a few programming notes before we close. Our teams will be attending two large conferences in the next few weeks. The first is the CRE Finance Council's annual June 2023 conference in New York City. That is on June 12th, and we'll have a booth there with our subsidiary, CRE Direct, and we'll have two meeting rooms. So book some time with us, reach out, and we'll set up a meeting. The podcast team will also be there. And then we'll also have our global team in Barcelona at the annual Global ABS event that same week. So if you'll be at either of these events and want to meet with us, send us an email and we'll get you set up with the right people. And then turning to shout outs. So since we were in California last week, we have a lot to cover today. So I'll run through these quickly. Dennis B. reached out. He said he loves the pod and he was looking for some more industrial commentary. So for today, this is the comment, but we'll make sure to give you some more stories going forward. Our own Justin N. is a new intern who already knew and loved the podcast before even starting here. So thank you, Justin. And then we got a lot of requests for a bank concentration report. Trevor D., Yi G., Robin L., Ryan K., Eric F., Mitchell G., Brad K., Brett M., RD, Theo M., and John P., they all sent us comments, very nice comments from all across the industry as well. And then even more for the bank concentration report, probably 20 more. So we'll get to you guys in the next few weeks. Then we had some people from the NAOP event reach out to us saying thank you. So we had Colin N., Greg C., John M., Katie C., Nicholas G., Tyler A., and a few more. We won't get to them all today, but then some exciting ones. We did have a few people reach out to us from Australia, which was pretty cool to hear. Stephen N. said he finds the podcast very useful for CRE monitoring. U.S. developments have a bearing on Australian CRE, so thanks for reaching out to us. And then also Jeff L. reached out from Australia. So a big week for listeners from around the globe. And then a few other nice comments from Margot L., Gabriel D., Colin M., and Tammy G., who liked the podcast last week. So thanks all for reaching out.
That was some mouthful, Haley. You got extraordinary feedback from that Silicon Valley thing. So it sounded like it was a real hit. It's interesting here at Trep. Whenever a podcast comes in, we all see it. Lonnie and I and Haley and the rest of the marketing team. And it feels like it's been filling up my inbox with extraordinary frequency over the last week or two. So well done.
Yeah, it's great to get the feedback from our listeners. So we really enjoy it. If you have an interest, reach out to us. We're pretty approachable. And as Haley mentioned, in many of these instances, we were able to send across the slide deck that was used at the NAOP event or some of the bank concentration reports or anything else. So if you hear something on the pod that intrigues you or interests you, feel free to reach out at podcast@trep.com and we'll do our best to get you what you need.
Normally we end our podcast with a slice of life commentary, but this week we're going to pivot to something just a little different. This is a day of mixed emotions for us. We have to say we are super excited to have Haley join us as our full-time co-host, a role she is well-trained for, having been behind the glass for more than a year, listening to us. At the same time, we have to wish the best of luck to Martha Kocher. Kudos to Coach. She is the one that conceived of the Trepwire podcast over 3 years ago, and she saw us through what we call the tin can and fishing wire early days of the podcast, when we were just trying to figure it out. And, you know, she was there week in, week out. I'm not sure she ever missed one, and really was the brain child behind the entire podcast. Martha has moved on to new things, and we so wish her 100% the best of luck in the future. We will miss her.
Well said, man. Thank you for just sending off Martha the way that you did. So I appreciate that.
And I echo those sentiments as well, Manus, and I definitely have big shoes to fill. So with that, we'll close. Join us next week as we look at what's happened during the week and how it may be impacting you. If you have a question or a comment, send an email to podcast@trep.com and subscribe to the Trepwire podcast with your favorite provider. Thank you for listening and stay well.
All right.